All right. Let me see. It's Tuesday, February the 21st, and we're in Atchison, Kansas, at Palucci's.
You might recognize that voice. It's KCUR's Matthew Long Middleton, and I'm Gina Kaufman. About a year ago, Matthew and I took a little road trip up north to Atchison, a town on the Missouri River just about an hour north of Kansas City. By most accounts, the place to start your day in Atchison is Palucci's. It's an old-fashioned diner, Italian restaurant, deli, and lounge all in one. No bells and whistles when it comes to decor, just wood floors, cozy tables, and walls covered with historic photographs. The family business has roots going back more than 120 years.
I bought it from my mom about 40 years ago.
Your grandparents opened it in 1894.
Yes.
Meet the current owners of Palucci's, Marge and Mike Begley. They say a lot has changed since Mike's mom ran the place.
She had a much bigger candy counter than we got now. It's not penny candy anymore. It's 10 cents and a quarter, and everybody come in for penny candy back then in the 40s and 50s.
Candy may cost a lot more in 2017, but Palucci's is still a thriving business with a young staff and lots of breakfast regulars.
They're very ornery, most of them. And they give almost all the waitresses a hard time, but we usually spit it right back.
That server, Molly Jamvold, she wears her curly hair in a no-nonsense ponytail that still manages to be stylish. And she's got a young, bashful smile that still manages to be friendly. She's a lot younger than the regulars she's calling ornery.
And I know they love us and we love them. I mean, we see their faces more than we see our actual families. And most of them are older, so they're like grandparents that, you know, some of us never had, I guess.
93-year-old Bill Grippin is one of those regulars. He's here every day for breakfast.
Biscuit and gravy and ring toasty.
Have you lived in Atchison your whole life?
93 years.
Wow.
I was in the moving business here most all my life. Household moving. I think I have been done moving in every state in the United States and Canada.
So you've seen people coming and going pretty up close.
All my life.
How do you think that in the time you've lived in Atchison, how do you think that the town has changed?
Went down considerable. Back when I was born, there was around 15,000 people there, and now they're lucky to be 10. And the economy is so much different. What we used to take a lot of time to do, you do in short time now. And I hope Atchison is progressing, but in my own opinion, it isn't. And it's terrible to say, but...
Is there a time that you would point to as like a golden age of some kind?
The 40s. Just graduated from high school. This restaurant, for example, was one of the hot spots right here, right where we're sitting. The depot was right across the street. Yeah, it was all the activity you wanted right here in this block, really. Another big hotel over the corner, Second and Commercial.
Why do you think things changed?
Well, time, everybody left, you know, to take jobs other places and go other places. And the military took a lot of us away. All my friends are gone. I mean, you know, the ones that aren't gone, I'm burying.
As someone in the moving business, did you have to help a lot of the people who left? Did you have to pack them up and send them off?
Did that forever. I don't know. I think you've asked kind of a poor one about what to do about Atchison. I can't really tell you. We have Amelia Earhart days that bring a few extra to town. I think St. Benedict's the College is our big business here now.
Yeah.
Our foundry business here is real slow. I don't think you can name any business in Atchison outside of maybe Midwest Solvents. It's been growing and holding its own. Remember what was their head of Midwest Solvents? It was a plow company, made plow shears, had a poultry house across the street, but we don't have much else right now bringing anything to Atchison. and I think we're a little off the beaten path.
Is there something about Atchison that people who live here really know and love about it that you think you have to be from here to appreciate?
Pretty much. Just kind of laid back and you kind of roll with the tide. We have a lot of newcomers come in that college material that's going to change the world, but whether it does or not, it's, I don't know.
That's Atchison old timer Bill Grippin. We'll be digging into some of these economic topics in a few minutes. Some business and development folks have a more optimistic attitude, but first, let's head across the street. An old limestone building tells the history of this place.
This is an 1880 freight depot built for the Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe Railroad.
There's lots of them been traveling for quite a spell, all the way from Philadelphia on the Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe.
Our guide here is Chris Taylor, executive director of the Atchison Historical Society. He's got a strawberry blonde ponytail and a ruddy complexion.
And this was supposed to be a model for other freight depots that they would build in large freighting communities. But for whatever reason, this is the only one they ever did like this.
It's cool. I like how the light just like floods in through these arched windows.
So, like I said, it's a really interesting building. People come in and they usually look up because you have this unique truss system up here that holds the building together and gives you a big wide open space down the middle of it.
The whole time you're here, you can hear the sounds of trains, which is odd.
We are now a quiet town. Trains don't actually sound the horns like you hear in the building.
Yeah. So I was wondering, I was like, that's weird, I didn't hear that outside.
So if you hear the horn and the building's not shaking, it's the attract loop. If the building's vibrating, it's an actual train going by.
I like it. This museum takes us way back into Atchison history. I mean, even before the trains.
Well, one of the things I would start with is in our natural history exhibit. In the middle of it, we have a woolly mammoth tooth that was found right here in Atchison. And what this kind of connects to me is the glaciers were here about 12,000 years ago. And as they began to recede, the Missouri River had this new path carved that set this spot 12 miles further west than any place else below us. And that kind of sets up a lot of the history. That's kind of a defining thing for all the transportation issues that really established Atchison is what it is. In the broad history that we kind of look at, one of the things we like to point out is the name of our state is because of the Kansa Indians. The Kansa Nation first had their settlement at Independence Creek, which is the northern border of Atchison County between Atchison and Doniphan counties. And the Kansa had a very large village there. When Lewis and Clark came through in 1804, they said it was an abandoned village, but the Kansa were out hunting. And there were people from the Kansa tribe who were likely there watching Lewis and Clark but didn't want to be seen. Because they looked like an army expedition when they got here in 1804 on July 4th.
Over the next 100 years, European settlers pushed the Kansa out to Oklahoma. By the late 1800s, Atchison was a thriving town with so many wealthy businessmen that a group from Topeka, led by a guy named Cyrus Holliday, came here to raise money for a grand railway venture called the Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe.
They always call us the eastern terminus of that, but in reality, Topeka was where everything started. But except for they had to come up here to get the money, because you had rich people who wanted to invest in railroads, and when he came up here after getting the Kansas legislature to give him the right to build the railroad, he came to Atchison to find money, and he had to borrow money to take the train up to Atchison. And then he got $60,000 in investments in a September afternoon in 1859. That's probably like $1.5 million. So if seven people could show up in a small law office and write out checks for that today, you kind of get an idea of the money that was available for investment in Atchison at that time.
at some point in the 19th century, I know there was like really a boom, but then there was also a bust with the trains. Did Atchison experience the bust as well?
Absolutely. That supposedly the folklore is, and there's some truth behind it, in 1890, Atchison had more millionaires per capita than any place else in the world. And then you had the first Great Depression in the country in 1890, and Atchison was... it's very much embodied in the north end of town. You have these big mansions, and right beside them you have little small homes, because all these people had, they were still rich, but they didn't have any cash. The only thing they could get cash for was selling some of their land. So most cities you go to, all the big mansions are grouped together. Here you have mansions, and then you have small houses in between, another big mansion, because they sold off property in that great bust of 1890.
Chris Taylor says this decade was a turning point for Atchison.
Up until the 1890s, they were probably the rail center of Kansas. The only mistake they made in 1870, they didn't build the railroad bridge when the railroads first asked them to. So everything was coming across by ferry. In 1870, they said, build us a railroad bridge. And Atchison said, well, we've done all this other stuff. Can't you build your own bridge? And they said, of course. And they went to Kansas City, St. Joe, and Leavenworth, and they all built bridges ahead of Atchison. So it allowed everybody else to catch up and be competitive again. And so, you know, they were so far ahead, it lasted till 1890 that we were ahead. But by 1900, everybody else had caught up. And of course, Kansas City has the big wide areas for stockyards that Atchison doesn't have. And that Kansas City was going to be the dominant rail center because of that.
Still, the railroad remained significant. If you lived in Kansas, you called it the Santa Fe, but if you lived on the East Coast, it was called the Atchison. Chris says just the name of the town, Atchison, had a lot of cachet for investors.
Finally, by the end of the Great Depression, and as you go on through into the 50s and 60s, Atchison had used up most of its political capital. After the two flash floods in 1958 that wiped out the downtown, we got a disaster, a quick disaster proclamation so we could get assistance. And there's a gentleman named Courtney Turner, who is a philanthropist, and still his money is still supporting Atchison projects. He was on General Eisenhower's staff, who was at that point president. And so that was probably the last, you know, political connection very high up that got Atchison the ability to rebuild very quickly, because it was said that we were the town that wouldn't die, or called us Miracle City, because at the end of July in 1958, if you walk through downtown, you would think this town is done. There's, you know, you're going to have to tear down almost the entire downtown. But what it turned out to was this pedestrian mall, this thing that was unique at the time, kind of the strip mall concept before anyone else had looked at it. And it boomed for a short while, but unfortunately, it happened at just the wrong time. Because we were this big shopping hub. Everyone in the region came here, from Horton to St. Joe to all the people who came to Atchison to shop. So you have this destruction of a lot of the downtown. You rebuild part of it, but you have big parking lots at that point, but not as much retail. So it started off really good. When the new wore off of those businesses that came back, people realized, well, cars are better today. The roads are better today. We can go to Topeka to shop. We can go to Kansas City to shop. We, like every place else in America, the downtowns began to struggle through the 70s and 80s, and we kind of started off that era with a big boom, and then we kind of had a deeper slide than a lot of places, because we saw what it could have been, and then it changed to what pretty much everyone else was experiencing.
You can't leave the museum or the town without hearing about some of the notable characters from Atchison's past. A certain famous lady pilot, a newspaper man, and a pretty amazing bricklayer.
William Deefy Bowler. He was called Deefy. That wouldn't be politically correct in today's environment, but that was what his friends, his nephews, everyone called him. He lost his hearing at a very early age because of a disease, and he was never able to really speak very clearly. At the age of 10, because he had lost his hearing, he was playing on the railroad tracks with his friends, and an express train came through. And his friends got out of the way, but he didn't hear the train coming, and he was hit, and his legs were cut off just below the knee at two different heights. He had people build him a special pair of boots that we have on display, and they're two different heights because his legs were two different lengths.
What do you think it says about Atchison that the town remembers this man who laid the bricks and remembers him both by formal name and by nickname? Like, that's a level of familiarity with what in so many communities would be a forgotten figure from the past.
Well, I think it shows that there's this connection to people who were, you know, made a significant contribution. And D.F. Bowler still has a physical presence in Atchison on their brick streets. You know, he laid most of them. The 4th Street, unfortunately, had to be torn up and had some work done. And once they put it back, it's never been quite as smooth as it was before, when it was still his original work from years and years before. They said he would have been 6'4 if he hadn't lost his leg. So he was a very tall man. But laying bricks is one of those things that you have to stoop over and bend. And he didn't have to do that. He was at the right height. He just stood there and someone bringing him the bricks and he could lay them there. So his problem, his accident actually gave him something that he could do better than anyone else in the world, probably.
It makes me think about that when we were just at Paolucci's, there seemed to be just characters who everybody knows in town.
I think you have to give some credit to that to Ed Howe, who founded the Atchison Globe back in 1877. And he was a champion of the everyday person. He wrote books, he was the owner of the newspaper, and he promoted Atchison, but he also promoted Atchison people. From two brothers who ran a eating establishment that he thought was extraordinary, to D.F. Bowler, pretty much anyone, maybe except women. For some reason, he was never a big fan of promoting women too much. But he kind of promoted the town and the people who literally built the town. There's one other person, you know, who's maybe not as famous. He's not as famous as he should be, Jesse Stone. He was the grandson of slaves. He was born here in Atchison. His grandfather was a blacksmith, but he is now in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He's most noted for writing the song Shake, Rattle, and Roll. Jesse Stone, he understood the music business, that he was a performer in the very early days. He wrote some of the jazz standards. Idaho is one of those that was recorded by a lot of people. But he was one of the founders of Atlantic Records, and it took a long time for Jesse Stone to ever get that recognition. Even though he continued writing, he wrote over 400, maybe to 600 songs in his lifetime.
We've got to take a break, but I'll be back in just a minute to hear more from historian Chris Taylor. He'll be talking about Atchison's most famous daughter, best known for the mystery that still surrounds her today. But was Amelia Earhart's time in Atchison really that significant? This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're back at the Museum of the Atchison Historical Society. Today, we're on a field trip to the town of Atchison, about an hour north of Kansas City, and we're asking how this Kansas town, with so much of its identity rooted in the past, is defining itself today, and how Atchison is trying to position itself for the future. I'm in an old train depot with historian Chris Taylor asking about the woman whose story looms large here.
So Amelia Earhart, she didn't live a long time in Atchison, but that seems to be, I mean, even coming in off the highway, you see signs. I mean, there are pictures of her everywhere you go, and she seems to be an important part of Atchison history, even if she spent very little time in Atchison herself.
If you were looking at contributions to the city of Atchison, she wouldn't rank very high in that regard. But her style, her importance to women overall across the country, it's something that Atchison has really connected to, more so in, you know, probably after her death than any other time. She was a constant visitor throughout her life. She was born here. She went through about to the age of 10 or 12, living here almost year-round, almost the time. When she finally moved with her parents to Kansas City and then to Iowa later, and then they started moving around, she always visited because she always had cousins here. Right up until 1937, just before she took off on her flight, she came through, she stopped and left notes for some of her friends and cousins in Atchison. She came back for the Kansas Editorial Convention in 1935. It was her last public appearance in Atchison. And there are all these photographs of people wanting to be photographed with her. You know, groups of kids who knew who she was because she was the Michael Jordan of the 1930s. What she did and what she meant to the world, I think Atchison really connected with that, that someone from this small town living in a home right here in Atchison, overlooking the Missouri River, could become someone literally everyone in the world knows who she is. And I think that's why, even though she didn't spend a tremendous amount of time here, her impact on the people was very great. She may not have contributed.
She symbolizes possibility?
I think that's a good way to say it, that she symbolized what could happen to anyone coming from here.
Do you have a favorite thing? I'm kind of loving this painting of her. She's got like a rose, dusty rose-colored scarf blowing in the wind as though she is in flight right now, but she looks like she's sitting on the side of an ocean.
Well, there's so many artworks that depict to me Earhart. It's really kind of hard to pick one of those that, you know, really stands out. To me, one of the things that I think is interesting, we have one of her leather flight jackets, but there are other leather flight jackets out there as well. I think the thing that always connects to people here is this watercolor painting she did as a child, that it's from the view from her grandfather's house, Judge Otis, and it shows the Missouri River with just the railroad bridge, the toll bridge.
I guess what stands out to me is just the idea that she was already looking at the world from this bird's eye view.
Now, it looks a bit different than in her time, but I think that's something of inspiration. A lot of people go up there for the festival, and I think they're looking for maybe that same inspiration that she had.
Chris Taylor is executive director of the Atchison Historical Society. Atchison is a town steeped in the past, but there are people trying to make a future here. Back across the street at Paolucci's Diner, a couple of the young servers give us their take on the town. Molly Jamvold is 23. She tells us something a lot of people have mentioned, that Atchison, Kansas is one of the most haunted places in the country.
Well, I actually live in one of an old house up on 4th Street, and I'll hear doors open that are like supposed to be closed, and I'm just like, I'm not even going to go check that out. I'm just going to go back upstairs because I live in the master suite. And then there's a house down from us towards Division that has gargoyles, and the story is that some guy tried to take them down, and he fell, and then he died. And also Sally's house, about the little girl that scratches people, like, in their sleep, so they'll wake up. They've had people stay there, and they'll wake up with scratches. So I've actually never stayed there. I'm probably too chicken.
Ghosts aside, Molly loves the old historic houses here.
Usually we sit outside on the deck and just watch cars drive up and down the street, and the view is incredible. Usually from any part in Atchison, the view is incredible.
Do you think that you will stay in Atchison?
For the time being, I'm happy here. I can't see myself settling down here. I would love to go to a city, like a big city, where there's just cars like flying by every day, and I would love to take the interstate to work every day. Kansas City, you know, St. Joe's only 20 miles from here, and it's a little bigger than Atchison. So it's more of a city, but I would rather just skip St. Joe and go straight to Kansas City, or even Dallas or LA. I just would love to be in a city, a big city.
First impression was it was small, kind of dumpy.
Paul Schneider still has a very boyish look. He came here 4 years ago from Cincinnati to study at Benedictine College.
Since being here, it's been really great. I really like the community here, actually, just because of how small it is and how friendly everyone is here.
What is nice about a small place?
I think it's the interaction of the people. I mean, everyone's got a story, everybody's willing to share it with you, and then here everyone's so willing to help each other out.
Is there something that you understand about living here that you think that people who haven't lived in a smaller town like this maybe don't get?
I wouldn't say they don't get it. It's almost forgotten or lost. It's the sense of just recognizing your fellow human beings and interacting with them on a daily basis. It's too often you just walk by other people, you don't even acknowledge them. So I think that's the best part about a small town.
Paul and Molly both appreciate life in a small town, or really, a big town, or micropolis, as places the size of Atchison are being called these days. It has a population of 11,000, but as much as Paul and Molly like it here, will there be enough jobs for young people like them who want to stay? KCUR's Laura Ziegler has also been visiting Atchison over the past couple of months, and she's looked into what it would take for this 19th century gateway to the West to become a thriving modern-day community. And you'll never guess where she started her reporting.
Palucci's is, of course, the place to get breakfast in Atchison, so that's where I recently went to meet Jeff Boldridge.
Okay, how do you want your eggs?
Easy.
Bacon or sausage?
Boldridge is a big guy. He played high school football, but he's super youthful looking at age 30. He's got a cap of black curly hair and a darkish 5 o'clock shadow. When I meet up with him, he's just off a 12-hour shift with Nestle Purina Pet Care Company in St. Joe, where he makes dog food.
Kind of boring at times, working nights a little suspect, but there's really nothing around here.
Boldridge is like hundreds of people in Atchison who've had to leave town to find jobs. The changing economy, less manufacturing-based, more global, has cut job opportunities. He spent 6 months working on a conveyor belt at Bradkin Engineered Products Division right out of school. Bradkin began as the Atchison Foundry in 1872, making parts for train cars. In its heyday, there were three shifts and the plant ran 24/7. Today, there's one shift, Monday through Friday, and it's a multinational operation. Boldridge's next job was at Northwest Pipe, which made steel pipes for oil and gas. He was hired and fired and rehired, along with fluctuations in the price of oil, until finally the place shut down.
January of 2016 is when everybody got the boot. Everybody.
While most of Kansas is focused on agriculture, manufacturing has long been an economic driver in Atchison. But the second largest industry in town might surprise you. It's education. Benedictine College on the bluffs overlooking the Missouri River struggled during the 70s and 80s. Aggressive marketing and a campus-wide facelift have created a building renaissance. Enrollment has tripled in the last several decades, adding juice to the local economy, says Benedictine Marketing Director Steve Johnson.
Students spending money in local stores, and parents coming into town and staying in hotels and going to restaurants, and all of the construction that we've been doing over all these years. We have a $70 million capital project going on right now, and the number of local contractors who are involved in that, it's a huge boost to the economy.
And there are other bright spots on the economy, too. On Commercial Street, not far from downtown Atchison, you see a behemoth factory of metal columns, cylinders, and huge boxy buildings. It's the MGP Ingredients Distillery. To me, it looks like an oversized version of a kid's toy with geometric shapes that snap together. The company's VP of Public Relations is Steve Pickman. He's an old newspaper guy. And as he casts his gaze up toward the sun-bathed distillation tower, the smoke billowing against the brilliant blue sky, he suggests a photo op.
Well, that's not a bad shot right here.
MGP was once the largest provider of industrial alcohol for fuel during World War II. It was started by the Atchison-based Cray family, pillars of the community who still have a majority share. They've added a plant in Indiana and have expanded into wheat-based food supplements. But MGP is known for booze, standard gin and vodka made from corn, and its signature premium drink called Till American Wheat Vodka.
Till Vodka, which is our own brand, is the exception. That's made strictly and totally from wheat, from Kansas.
By the proud men and women of Atchison, Kansas.
That's MGP President and CEO Gus Griffin. He can barely contain his pride as he talks about the Norman Rockwell values attached to Till Vodka, and by extension, to MGP.
Trust, integrity, honesty, hard work, things that are symbolic with the Midwest.
The description's important for a couple of reasons. First, Gus Griffin isn't even from the Midwest. He grew up in a small town like Atchison, but in Pennsylvania. He was brought in to grow the company in part by promoting the heartland values it represents. And it's working. The company quadrupled its operating income in the first year of Griffin's strategic plan. 220 people work here today. That may not sound like a lot, but in the employment landscape in Atchison, it is. And plans are to add jobs soon. Griffin says the success of MGP is directly tied to the ethos of Atchison.
I think it's a small town. I think it's the family background of the business, and that everybody feels their efforts not only affect them, their neighbors, their families, but we're all working for a common good.
Pretty much to a person, the people I met here wanted to stay here and to make Atchison better. But how is Atchison really doing? Well, it depends on who you ask. Boosters will point to the new Holiday Inn Express under construction and the brand new YMCA downtown, the growth of Benedictine College, and the way investors are turning the obsolete factories and declining businesses into thriving niche markets. But Atchison still has a 6% unemployment rate that's 2 points higher than the rest of Kansas, and the future of some of the largest employers remains uncertain. So it's probably most accurate to say that Atchison is in transition, balancing the iconic identity it's so connected to with the racing global marketplace that demands change.
Since this story aired back in April of 2017, the unemployment rate in Atchison County has actually dropped to about 4.5%. It does remain just a little higher than the rest of the state. Atchison's identity is grounded in the past. There's an appeal in those train whistles blowing and that old-timey feel for tourists and residents. But for the sake of surviving, nay, thriving, Atchison has to exist in today's economy. Can it do both? Justin Prejeant may just be our best bet at getting an answer. He's an ambitious young guy who grew up in Atchison. But instead of pouring his energy into becoming a hotshot in a bigger city, he's doubled down on making his own hometown as good as it can be. At 30 years old, he's the city's director of public works and utilities. Hi, Justin.
Hi.
What's a typical day like for you as Atchison's director of public works and utilities?
Wow, a typical day.
Yeah. Is there such a thing?
I've been told I have the city's largest email account in terms of size. So a lot of communication back and forth, a lot of trusting the good staff that I have underneath me to handle situations as they come up.
What kinds of situations?
Oh, anything from water main breaks to issues with contractors on utility projects. In a city of our age, there's a lot that can go wrong. That's why I enjoy what I do, is there's not really a typical day outside of some regular staff meetings. It just depends.
You grew up in Atchison and you left for a brief time, but did you always know you'd come back?
No, not always. This is a very strange thing to say, and I don't know if it will make sense to people, but I hope that it connects with somebody. A couple of guys, one of them I went to high school with, who I'll say 6 years ago came back to Atchison and opened like a sports bar and grill. It's a nice place. It's the best sit-down restaurant in town. And until that place opened, I didn't have my head around moving back there. So that seems like a goofy thing to say, like, oh, well, a bar opens and now you're willing to move back to your hometown. And maybe I would have wound up there anyway. But once that place opened and I spent some time there on Christmas break or whatever.
So you just needed one cool place to hang out.
For me, that's maybe what the tipping point was. Maybe for somebody else, it's a walking trail or a dog park. Or I went to high school and college there. I went to Benedictine College is there, and they've had a great resurgence. I know I was ready to leave and go do something else.
As many high school graduates are.
Of course. And what I found is young people from Kansas City and even young people from bigger cities than Kansas City feel like, oh, I got to get out of this, you know, cowtown. Oh, I need to, and they go to Chicago or go to, everybody wants to go somewhere bigger and do something better. I don't know. We'd talked about the possibility of being there. It wasn't like it wasn't considered, but the first time I was excited about it was when they opened. And I also didn't know professionally if there was going to be a spot for me, right? Like that's a big challenge.
You needed two very basic things, a job and a place to hang out.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you boiled it down to essentially exactly. And one of the things we try to do is grow entrepreneurship so that maybe people don't think of employment as I need a spot. maybe you can create your own spot. So that's a big tenet of what we try to do, but that's, even on that, progress is incremental and slow.
Talk to me about growing up in Atchison. Where did you live and what was it like?
I lived in a neighborhood that's, I'll say, downtown adjacent. I remember riding my bike all over town, even riding in the grass next to the highways, which would probably terrify my mother when she hears this. but riding my bike anywhere and everywhere, out to the municipal pool, mostly going to the video game rental store. I had a fantastic upbringing there. I couldn't say enough good things about it, which I guess my wife and I have a four-month-old daughter now, and so as we were transitioning into that phase, like, this was a really cool place to grow up, and it's a place you can get your arms around. Like, it has a soul.
So when I think about, for you, there's this balance between, you know, you have really fond memories of growing up in Atchison and want to preserve so much about what you loved then and continue to love now. But you also have enjoyed, as you put it, incremental change in the form of a bar. And I'm guessing would like to see some more of that. I mean, what are other things that someone your age kind of craves living in Atchison?
I want to see construction and development, specifically downtown and in the downtown adjacent, mid-rise and small apartment buildings on vacant lots that have been there for since I was born.
Why do you want that? Why apartment buildings?
We have old, underutilized stocks of buildings and lots that have been vacant for a period of time. We stand to benefit from the tax base that would create. There's a lot of benefit for us, for the county, for the school district, in growing our tax base. I think that should be the goal of every municipality, is to thrive financially. And the way you do that is through elevating your tax base.
But I wonder, just as a person who lives there, as a person who's 30 years old, your day-to-day life, like with a four-month-old, you were saying, what are the things that think, oh man, I wish we just had this, or like, it would really be so great if down the street there were that.
Yeah, we hear about them all the time. Perhaps that's because folks know who are the folks who are, you know, executives at the city. They know who we are, and they're not shy about telling us that we want a movie theater. Our movie theater closed in 2011. We really want one back. Prior to this, you know, we heard a lot from Benedictine. They really wanted a hotel. Well, we've actually got a new downtown Holiday Inn Express project that's going to be open this September. But there are limitations, of course. I mean, I've made the phone call to every small town movie theater developer that I've been able to come across, and it's just not certain enough. It's too risky for them because we don't have enough population. If we were one of the reasons that I think we haven't lost population, being the size that we are, is that it took me an hour to get here from Atchison today. It takes 45 minutes to get to Legends. It takes 40 minutes to get to St. Joe, Missouri. That's sort of the blessing and the curse of being so close, is there are a lot of people who live in Atchison who wouldn't be willing to live in a town that size if it were 2.5 hours away from all of those things that I mentioned. The downside of that is, because we're so close, we're not likely to see some of those retail developments or some of those entertainment developments because it's so easy to get there.
So as you think about that balance between preserving the history of Atchison and the authenticity, as you described it, while bringing in some of the things so that people maybe aren't so reliant on the day trip, is there something that, as you talk to friends and colleagues and neighbors about this, that seems like, yeah, everything else is great, but we won't achieve this unless X, Y, or Z happens? Like, if you had to pick one thing that is absolutely crucial for this to happen, what do you think it would be?
To me, it's housing. People want to live in a cool place.
I am so surprised to hear you say that, because the gorgeous old houses, that's part of what I heard from so many people that they liked about the town.
Perhaps it's an age thing. I don't know. My wife and I just undertook a project, and we actually moved in the same day we brought our daughter home from the hospital. But we renovated the upstairs of the old fire station, which is a 1912, 1913 constructed building, and nothing had been upstairs there since 1971. I think those are the types of places that people want to live. I do feel like that's one of our barriers to having some of those college students stick around or young professionals want to live there. I think that's the housing limitation. We're trying to do everything we can to incentivize those types of projects, and I think we'll get there, but it takes time.
Well, Justin, thanks so much, and keep us posted on all of your projects.
Sure. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. I appreciate it.
Justin Prejeant is the Director of Public Works for Atchison, Kansas. We checked back in with Justin just the other day, and he had some big news. Since our story originally aired a little more than a year ago, his dream of rehabilitating that movie theater is close to becoming a reality. Taking a cue from a nearby town with a thriving movie theater, the city decided not to wait for the private sector to take the initiative. They started looking at fundraising and grants for the project, and they've raised $1.5 million. Construction is expected to start by September. Coming up, we'll spend a night at the monastery at the top of the hill overlooking Atchison. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Stay tuned. This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. We're nearing the end of our hour in Atchison, but before we go, we've got to spend some time at a place that seems to have drawn a lot of people to Atchison to begin with. As we heard, the Catholic liberal arts school, Benedictine College, is an economic force here in town. And at the top of the hill behind the college is the Benedictine Abbey. The monks of the Atchison Abbey have lived here for decades. And although KCUR's Laura Ziegler is not someone we think of as particularly predisposed to monastic life, we sent her to spend the night in the abbey with the monks.
Benedictine College was started by the monks in 1857 to provide a Catholic education to the children of pioneers and to celebrate Mass with European settlers. Today, about 40 monks live here, the same way Benedictine monks have lived since Saint Benedict of Nursia established the order in 6th century Italy. Benedictines are one of the oldest monastic orders, and they've earned a reputation for emphasizing literacy and education, for being thinkers and philosophers. The Atchison Abbey is one of the oldest in the country. It started just as Kansas had opened to settlement. I decided to spend some time at the Abbey, and my overnight begins here at this peaceful spot surrounded by old evergreens overlooking the Missouri River. My guide is Abbey archivist Father Dennis Mead.
Over here we have in our cemetery about 200 of our deceased monks here, and in this semicircle here are our abbots, the abbots of our monastery. It gives where they were, when they were born, when they made their profession, when they made their first vows, when they made priestly ordination if they're a priest, and then when they died.
Father Dennis is a spry 87 whose only sign of age is a slight stoop in his shoulder. I'm with him for most of my next 24 hours, often finding myself in the shadow of his flowing black robe trying to keep up with his pace. Benedictine monks are sometimes called black monks because of their habit. Wandering the college grounds, I'm thinking about Harry Potter's Hogwarts. Father Dennis has been affiliated with the Atchison Abbey for 66 years. His only time away was for missionary work in Brazil and a study in Rome, where he witnessed the election of Pope John the 23rd in 1958.
The popes had a rather reserved. They didn't go out in the city of Rome much. But then he decided to change that tradition. So I was walking down in this narrow street, and I see two motorcycles coming along, putt, 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 putt. And then there was a car behind them, and they said, oh, I wonder who that is. So it was the Pope. He waved.
At the regular 5 p.m. Mass, students stream into the Abbey Church. They join the monks in the choir seats at the front of the nave.
Thanks be to God.
Let the just exalt and rejoice in the Lord.
Row by row, students and monks file out of the wooden seats and make their way to the altar to receive the Holy Eucharist. Monks with the Order of St. Benedict live by the Rule of St. Benedict, which lays out an exhaustive set of parameters for Benedictine monastic life. Many of the rules are outdated. For example, one says a monk must sleep in his habit but may remove his knife. The rules explicitly delineate the days, times, and order of prayers. Benedictines don't take vows of silence, but there are strict rules about when you can talk and when you can't. For example, they take their breakfast in silence, and at dinner they don't talk, but someone's at the front of the room reading an article about Benedictine history or a passage or two from the Rule of St. Benedict. After dinner, there are a few minutes of downtime. The monks converse in a living room where they go to their rooms. Then they quietly make their way back to church for Vespers. Again, Father Dennis is my guide and tutor.
We have a little introduction, which is sung, and then we sing this, and then we go to this book.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All the terrors of the night.
I have to admit that after a few hours at the Abbey, I was kind of anxious. I was starting to wonder how I'd make it through the next day. The spotty Wi-Fi, the silent supper, in fact, the quiet in general. But during these lovely Vesper services, I had a sense there was a collective lowering of blood pressure, an enveloping calm.
That in your spirit we may live.
After Vespers, Father Dennis escorts me down the long, dimly lit hall of the monks' living quarters, where the only sounds are the gentle thump, thump of an elderly father's walker. A disproportionate number of the monks here are elderly. The overall population has dwindled over the last 50 years, from some 130 to a few dozen today. But the Abbey is seeing an uptick in younger men committing to monastic life. In fact, studies show that while there's been a dramatic decline in the ordination of priests over the last 45 years, there's been a slight increase in those choosing to become monks in recent years. At the end of the hall, we run into Father Jay Kythe, the chaplain at Benedictine College. He says based on his experience talking to students, there's a reason younger people are choosing to become monks.
I always like to say that I was a child in the 80s. We were the me generation, very selfish. This generation is also the me generation with a lot of despair. And so there's a sense of apathy, there's a sense of lack of motivation. And they know that about themselves. That's the curiosity. They know that. And they don't quite know what to do about it.
What they call the night silence begins with the 8 p.m. bell. The monks retreat to their bedrooms. The monastery goes quiet. At 6 a.m., there are morning prayers, then breakfast. The food is simple, but good. One of the brothers has made a delicious sourdough bread. After breakfast is when the monks fan out into the community. They teach at the college and at the parish schools. They minister in hospitals, hospice homes, and prisons. Others take care of the administrative chores of keeping the Abbey up and running.
What do you want from Walmart here?
Father Ralph Kohler, he's a wise-cracking 87-year-old, a former abbot or head of the Atchison Abbey.
Here's a one that's writing a story. She wants to write a story about you.
I'm writing a story about
We love it when he comes in to shop because he always entertains us. Of course, if I'm on a ladder, he asks me if I get a raise. And,
you got to climb way up to the top of it at the shop.
And this guy, I don't know what you'd do without him.
This guy is Brother Tim McMillan. He's 28 and decided to join the monastery while at Benedictine College. He's a cheery redhead with a full red beard, and every Tuesday he takes Father Kohler out for the outing to Walmart. Brother Tim scours the shelves for grape nuts and batteries and deodorant while Father Ralph pushes the cart, stopping to engage workers.
Well, you know what day is tomorrow, don't you?
The starting of Lent.
Well, what's starting of Lent? What do you call it?
Today's Shrove Tuesday.
Yeah, I know.
Ash Wednesday.
Ash
Monday,
Wednesday.
Ash
Wednesday.
Good Friday.
That's good. Ash Wednesday. You know all those things, don't you?
I do. I'm a good Lutheran.
Is there such a thing?
Yes!
Just check on it.
Driving back from errands, it became clear to me that Atchison is used to these guys. I didn't see anything but affection towards them. Of course, they've been hanging around here for 160 years. Thinking about this live, I found it harder to understand how the younger guys could commit, like Brother Tim, who brings the elderly former abbot to town. Brother Tim took his vows last year. I asked him if he ever questions his decision.
Yeah, there's at times a temptation to kind of forsake the monastic life and experience other ways of life. But there are many, you know, different ways to live your life, but ultimately you kind of have to choose one. There are a number of people that one could marry, but you have to, at some point, you commit to one person. It's impossible and impractical to, you know, chase every desire because you're going to end up with nothing.
Later that morning, I went to say goodbye to the monks as I prepared to leave Atchison. I found Brother Levin Harton playing chess with a fellow Benedictine grad who now teaches philosophy there. Father Matthew Habiger was preparing to sit down and read the Wall Street Journal.
You might find it surprising, but a group of monks are very much attuned to the world they live in. We might seem like we're isolated from the world, but we're very much interested in what's going on locally, state-wise, nationally, and internationally.
But for Father Roderick Giller, not yet in his habit this morning and with brown suspenders holding up his pants, Abbey life provides something more basic, something essential.
I'm 82 years old. And I'm thankful that I don't have to worry about cooking my own food. I don't have to pay bills. We got a medical staff on duty 24/7. You know, I know when I die, I'll be buried in the Abbey Cemetery. I am thankful that I don't have to worry about all those things.
Father Roderick says without these worldly concerns, he's free to practice his vows, the vows of stability, obedience, and conversatio morum, conversion of customs or conversion to the monastic life. And he says he can focus on his departure from this earth. Laura Ziegler, KCUR 89.3.
Ad nos convertes.
KCUR's Laura Ziegler brought us that dispatch from the monastery on top of the hill in Atchison. This episode was originally broadcast in April of 2017. This has been a special episode of KCUR's Central Standard dedicated to that historic railroad town up north. You can listen to whatever you might have missed at kcur.org/centralstandard. If there's a community you think we don't talk enough about and want us to visit, drop us a line. You can email centralstandard@kcur.org or tweet us your idea. We are at @KCURCST. This episode was produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross with enormous contributions from Laura Ziegler. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date.